I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway. For years, disinformation has been festering online. You or someone you know might have come across some of these posts yourself. Unfounded claims, conspiracy theories, and stretched truths that are decades old can take on new life because of social media. Yet at a congressional hearing last year, CEO Mark Zuckerberg, you know, from Facebook, Meta, said that it was something the company has been able to handle.
I think we have, on COVID misinformation in particular, a relatively good track record of fighting and taking down lots of false content.
Zuckerberg even told CBS in an interview over the summer that Facebook alone had taken down millions of pieces of disinformation.
There are people who share misinformation, and that's why I said that we took down and have taken down more than 18 million pieces of harmful misinformation about this.
18 million posts being taken down sounds like a lot, but apparently not all misinformation is created equal. Communities that speak languages other than English, especially the Spanish-speaking communities, have largely been left to fight misinformation on their own. All right, so I want to play something for you, and I just want to warn you, this is an example of disinformation. It's being spread by Patty Navidad, a Mexican actress.
Es implantar chips en los seres humanos para controlarnos es también aplicar tatuajes de puntos cuánticos y vacunas con nanotecnología.
Now, what you just heard was a complete fabrication based on conspiracy theories. And as a result of this and similar claims, Navidad's Twitter account was suspended in 2021. But the repercussions against her, they're not very representative of what's been happening with other disinformation targeting Spanish language communities. A 2020 report by the advocacy group Avaaz found that Facebook failed to remove or even issue warnings for 70% of Spanish language content identified as misinformation. Compare that to only 29% of English language content being left alone. In fact, an internal memo from Facebook earlier this year showed that the company's ability to detect vaccine misinformation in non-English comments was, quote, basically non-existent. And all this means Spanish-speaking communities remain the target of largely unchecked disinformation. And there are real-life consequences for it. So let's talk about that. We spoke with Stephanie Valencia, co-founder and president of Equis Research, and Nora Benavides, who is senior counsel and director of the Digital Justice and Civil Rights Division of Free Press. I asked Nora how people can begin to prepare for disinformation that they come across online.
I think there are a number of things we can be doing. First and foremost is we can all begin discussing this as everyday people. It's sometimes seen as an expert topic, and it isn't. It's one that affects each of us, and it affects our families, our friends. And one of the problems that's most insidious, I think, is that we often feel it's an abstract concept. Like it affects those people over there and not me and mine. And yet disinformation by design is really intended to divide us. And so as we gear up for 2022, I think we're going to see a lot of narratives that undermine our trust in officials and in our institutions. And each of us can begin being on guard for that. First of all, our social media platforms can play a role. And we've seen in the lead up to the 2020 election, the way that Facebook, for example, put safety mechanisms in place to make sure that extremist or violent calls on their social media platforms were in fact not amplified. Unfortunately, those mechanisms were turned off after November. And I think much of what we saw in January and January 6th was fanned by how extremist content was amplified. So social media platforms really do have a critical role to play. Elections are happening all over the world. We have dozens of elections next year, not just in the United States. And we need those mechanisms for safety across the globe and across languages.
you know, kind of as I was preparing for our conversation, reading about numbers, which is probably like a segment all by itself, about the use of social media actually across age categories for Latinx folks living here in the U.S. And I just, I'm not sure that I've realized how pervasive the use of social media for just a wide variety of purposes is within Latinx communities. And I'm wondering, given Nora's point about the extent to which disinformation is amplified in those spaces, you know, if you can help us to make that connection with social media and disinformation targeted towards Latinx communities.
It is pretty astounding to understand kind of the scope and reach of social media, particularly the platforms of YouTube and WhatsApp with Latino voters and Facebook. You know, obviously WhatsApp is owned by Facebook, but Latinos are consuming twice as much information on YouTube than the regular population. And that is kind of everything from news and information to music videos, et cetera. And shockingly, from our kind of research in the past year, we have come to find that 70%, close to, you know, roughly two thirds of Latinos are getting their news and information about politics and elections from YouTube as a primary source, which means that they're not going to MSNBC or CNN necessarily, but they're searching out in the search bar on YouTube, you know, January 6th or Cuba protests or immigration, and they are getting news fed to them from, in some cases, not reputable news sources at all. People who are purporting to be news but aren't necessarily, and who are, in some cases, are outright disinformation. A lot of this is in English, but a lot of it is actually in Spanish. And part of what we have been trying to bring more attention to is the role that the social media platforms are playing in spreading Spanish language disinformation, and the asymmetry that exists in checking and kind of taking down at the same rates, the same narratives in English that are being spread aren't being necessarily taken down with the same speed or urgency that English language narratives are being taken down. And so this is a problem because as many of these narratives around disinformation or misinformation or conservative kind of re-education are being spread on YouTube or Facebook, they're often being spread even more virally via WhatsApp. We always joke about the viral memes that we get in our families, the Dios de bendiga memes that we get from our aunts and our cousins, or, you know, the have a good day and I love you memes that we get from our family. In the same way those spread very virally, we often get, you know, memes or other videos that are sharing on WhatsApp that is a closed platform, a very dangerously closed platform that is going almost completely unchecked for disinformation.
There's a way that this presumption that mainstream media is itself not creating disinformation, and I'm not trying to do like a fake news thing here, but that actually even within our mainstream sources, it can sometimes be tough to know that what we're getting is something that we can trust.
Absolutely. And so much research has now gone into studying and trying to ascertain what trust means, because I think trust is at the heart of all of it. You know, if you and I are Facebook friends and Melissa, you post something, I would guess that the kind of credibility I somehow bestow upon your post, even implicitly, means that I'll just sort of take whatever you've shared as real and as credible. So the first step in this huge table, I think, is the way we're engaging with information among informal friends. And that means if you post something from CNN, I see that headline. I'm not even sure many people click on links. Many people only read headlines. And the trust that they have among their communities is the highest. And then it plummets. People do not trust national media as much as they trust local news. And yet local news is suffering greatly, as many of us know, in part because social media is now the primary pathway for people to get information. So CNN, sure, that is absolutely one of the questions worth considering. But the biggest sort of step back is, what are we trusting and what are we not trusting? Disinformation absolutely has helped kind of sow that distrust. so that your social media feed may look very different from mine. And then when I come to the table with you and with Stephanie to discuss facts, the facts that I have seen, and I'm putting facts in air quotes here, they could be drastically different from the things you are seeing. Maybe you're seeing the CNN reports on a certain topic, and I'm seeing something drastically different on Fox. And the kind of division that comes out of all of this is because the different news pathways for us are things that we think everyone is seeing.
You know, one of the things that is actually, I think, a feature, not a bug, for those who are trying to sow this discord and division is to actually just create a lot of distrust. And like, the distrust is the goal, because distrust in democracy, distrust in institutions, whether those are politicians or candidates, distrust in any number of things that we engage in our everyday lives, that distrust can often lead to less political participation, you know, more resignation around the political process. And so as it relates to especially like communities of color, that is actually a very dangerous proposition, just creating that distrust so that people stay on the sidelines and not participate because they feel like they can't or they shouldn't, or they've just created this notion of distrust and disbelief that forces people to not want to trust anything. So I think that is one of the most dangerous features about what we're seeing with disinformation, is this like deeper sentiment of distrust that we're going to have to contend with. That being said, when we think about like antidotes, you know, Nora said earlier, there's been a lot of research to try to understand how do we create better trust? How do we better label content to news, quote unquote, news content or political content to encourage people to ask questions. We ultimately have to work to create, we have to do all the stuff to keep social media platforms accountable, but we also have to create smarter and more critically thinking and probing consumers. Like, we also have to encourage people to like ask questions and question, where am I getting that information? What does the other side say? And that is like a bigger challenge and a bigger goal that we have to kind of take on to, again, create better trust and information sharing. The third piece I would say, as like a critical antidote, is ensuring, kind of, Melissa, what you were just saying, is how do we flood the zone with good news and facts about COVID that are just as interesting and shareable as that Dios te bendiga meme or the, you know, interesting video that went viral that was kind of fake news. And so that is the kind of stuff that we have to be able to kind of try to think around, how we are able to create that kind of creative content that is also shareable in a way that gets good news and facts into the bloodstream.
I want to be really concrete with an example here, because I think this can, as I mentioned at the top, feel really abstract. Yeah. So let's just sort of think about some of the examples we saw in the 2020 election. And there is a single example I often use because I think it's so potent. An image that went viral on social media before the 2020 election was a photograph of what appeared to be ballots, that is mail-in ballots, that were thrown in a trash bin. And frankly, I would be really concerned if I saw that image. And if, Melissa, you sent that to me on WhatsApp, or if I saw that on Twitter, I would absolutely be worried about a whole host of things. I think one is, oh my gosh, will my vote be thrown in the trash if I mail it in? Is the election rigged? Is this some kind of political or partisan effort? And then I think the underlying and real heart of it is, should I even vote at all? And that is part of why disinformation can be so insidious. What we learned about that image, though, and this is what's so hard to your question about how do we build up resilience and education and sort of curiosity, is that it takes time, because it took so much time to unearth that that image was taken of 2018 envelopes in California for the votes that were mailed in 2018. And by statute, are you ready? They had to be kept for a certain period of time. And so the image was real. It wasn't doctored, but the image was so evocative because it made at least me, and I think thousands of others, believe a whole host of things that then led to our deeper distrust of democracy. And that is the whole point.
I think about, so I've been an educator for more than 20 years now, and
that initially in teaching like critical media literacy, part of what we would do is to teach you to distrust sources of information and not distrust like distrust them full scale, but to ask certain kinds of questions of them. And yet at this moment, we're also talking about building trust. And I guess I worry that the desire to build trust could then, you know, perhaps actually lead us to trust sources that are inaccurate. So again, I so appreciate this very specific example. So let me just say, you know, if someone were to say to me, oh, you know, a police officer, you know, had his foot on someone's neck for, you know, for all of these minutes and then that person perished and it happened and in a large crowd and everyone saw it. I mean, my first reaction might be like, come on now, like that, come on. Did that really happen? That idea that sometimes the realities are sort of horrifying enough or stressful enough or so beyond what we think of as normal actions, take January 6th, that we would initially be distrustful of them, but those are actually the things that really happened. So I guess I'm asking you here about how to approach the question of critical media literacy, how to ask the right questions of things like those images without simply being a person who presumes that all news is fake news.
I think the easiest first thing that I always recommend for people, it may sound corny, but it's to slow down, to take a breath and to basically always promise to breathe and slow down before you share something. And I think the other piece of it is how we engage with media and how media brings readers in to actually report better, to report on things that readers need and to make context obvious, you know, trying to bring context and history where otherwise I think our media has a very long arc of largely ignoring and miscommunicating about specific communities.
The one thing I would just add, I mean, I agree with what everything Nora said. I do think, though, we have to kind of talk about like the root of the challenge and the problem as it relates to the platforms, which is a couplefold. One is that they are not treating Spanish language disinformation with the same kind of urgency and set of resources as they are English language disinformation. One of the statistics that we cite is that Facebook failed to issue warning labels on upwards of 70% of misinformation in Spanish compared to 29% in English. They're not treating Spanish language content with the same level of scrutiny and the same level of kind of integrity checks as they are English language media or English language disinformation and narratives. And in addition, we also have to kind of take into account the algorithmic kind of reward system that has been created by the platforms to reward some of this content that goes more viral. And ultimately, many of the producers of this content are actually making money off of it, including the platforms, right? One last example that I will use very concretely is last summer during the height of the George Floyd uprisings, what we saw in Spanish language disinformation spaces were racially driven tropes to divide between African Americans and Latinos. We've similarly seen similar tropes related to immigration and immigrants in the African American community being spread. And so those are like the kind of things that people are dropping in very divisive narratives to tap into kind of the greatest fears or, ill-conceived notions that people may have to reinforce some of those biases that is incredibly, incredibly problematic. It may not be considered outright disinformation, but the way people are using imagery and words to kind of, again, reinforce bias is a really, really terrible thing.
And Stephanie, can you say one more word here to also, because I think it's so useful how you talked about this use of a kind of wedge between groups of color. But can you also maybe say a few words about presumptions, both for those who might be advocating against disinformation and those who are actually producing and making use of and misinformation of a kind of singular or monolithic Latinx community?
when you look at the community, you know, there is such a diversity of issues that matter in key parts of the community. For example, socialism resonates in a very different way in Florida than maybe it does in Arizona. And the issue of immigration may resonate in a very different way in places like South Texas and Arizona than it does in other parts of the country. And so again, we are seeing a lot of kind of micro-targeted disinformation efforts in some of these more localized communities based on what the community in that particular region or area is experiencing or kind of it places importance. I'll use the example of South Florida as kind of a media ecosystem that conservatives have really invested in, from YouTube to radio to kind of the online radio, you know, ecosystem of, you know, just Facebook and WhatsApp. So WhatsApp, you know, again, is this place where these memes are shared very virally. In places like South Florida, you have YouTube influencers, conservative YouTube influencers like Alex Otayola, who was a former Clinton supporter turned Trump supporter, who, you know, has built a YouTube following and does kind of gossipy type videos every day, but streams in and plugs in a lot of conservative policy content. He's had Donald Trump on his show multiple times, a lot of Hispanic conservative influencers on his show, and is using kind of his platform as kind of this gossipy, you know, columnist on YouTube to kind of put cards in his cards in the stack of conservative kind of re-education. Meanwhile, you also have a radio station that was purchased in South Florida by conservative backed entities for $350,000 last April. And so Democrats, on the other hand, spent $14 million in paid advertising in the same media market in the last 30 days of the 2020 election. So you have Republicans who are thinking in terms of sharing and coordinating messaging, both disinformation and just like conservative re-education, by buying radio stations. So they have platforms year-round, 24/7, to distribute that news and information. And Democrats are still very much focused on buying paid media and just like burning money on fire at the end of an election cycle, trying to talk to these voters. And so there's also an asymmetry of tactics between the left and the right in terms of information distribution and how to kind of think about educating and reaching and persuading voters.
Well, local news is on the decline, and the, I would say, aggressive decline over the last 15 years, more than 25% of newspapers have closed. And because of COVID, that problem has now been compounded. So we know that furloughs, layoffs, mergers have contributed to less and less news around the country. And for local communities, that means that they are actually less civically engaged. We know that where local news exists, there is more robust engagement. And where local journalism, for example, is on the decline, where it withers, or where local radio stations close, where local papers close, a few horrible consequences always follow. There are examples that corporate malfeasance goes up, local government salaries go up when local news leaves, and then people are less likely to know when elections are, they are less likely to vote. All of that getting to, I think, your question and sort of the underlying issue here of how are we making communities connected and better connected to news, and how is media better serving communities? And that is a very big question because of the asymmetries that Stephanie has laid out. And I think some of the financial incentive models now, because of our social media platforms, they are in a position where their revenue is so much greater that they are now the primary pathway for information for consumers. And the upstream systemic failures on the platform to give people credible information mean that they play a more responsible role than I think we often, even in a public discourse, push upon them. And I'm glad that Stephanie mentioned some of those upstream systemic issues. One other example I was thinking about as Stephanie was talking is research from The Markup, which has shown that Black, Latino, Indigenous, Middle Eastern Facebook users have been shown less credible COVID-related information from the World Health Organization. Why is that? How do we somehow give people information they need and push that out, where organizations like the World Health Organization, I think, have good intent. And yet what we are seeing then is a kind of model and incentive structure that clearly isn't giving people equitable information across identity. And so it's a very, very difficult question. Ahead of 2022, I think one of the most important takeaways for us is the power of engagement journalism, that among all of the systemic failures we will be trying to correct course on, we need media to be really centering and answering questions that communities have legitimate interest in knowing about. And then we need to be pushing for reforms that I think are more on the systemic side. And so I've mentioned to many, and I'm very excited that this week we at Free Press have been working with the Disinfo Defense League to launch a policy platform that can be one avenue. It is not the only avenue. It is not the silver bullet, but it is one important avenue to think about regulatory and policy reforms. Because across all of the ways that we consider solutions, I think we need a real kind of wraparound approach. We need media literacy. We need policy reforms. We need media to be engaged. And so in trying to give everyday people a roadmap, the Disinfo Defense League has created this policy platform that really is a launching pad that centers civil rights. We are centering privacy, the need for transparency from platforms as a place to go when members of Congress and others say, how do we correct course? What is the role that regulators play? What is the role that policymakers play? We are trying to answer that question, at least getting us to a place where by 2022 and 2023, we are better positioned to have strong, robust digital ecosystems.
I think I was just going to add quickly to what Nora said is not forget this notion that 70% of Latinos are getting their news and information about politics and elections from YouTube as a primary source. 70% to over two-thirds of Latinos are getting their news and information from YouTube. And so as we think about where people are getting that news and information, I think we have to be really creative around how and where we're reaching people. To me, the biggest competition for news organizations like Univision and Telemundo is YouTube, because that is where Latinos are consuming news and information. And we have to think creatively about authentic and organic channels and ways that are going to provide mechanisms to, give quality news and facts to people in bite-sized ways that are going to help people to make sense of the world and who they are in the world, where they fit in the world, and all of those pieces, what's happening in the world, as a mechanism to ensure people are getting good news and facts.
Stephanie Valencia is co-founder and president of Aquis Research, and Nora Benavidez is senior counsel and director of the Digital Justice and Civil Rights Division of Free Press. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you so much, Melissa.
Thanks, Melissa.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
Hi, I'm Helga Davis. On my show, I speak with artists and thinkers about how to uncover the extraordinary in everyday life. People like musicians Brittany Howard and Sampha, Broadway director Whitney White, scholar Noli Way Rooks, and playwright Suzanne Laurie Parks. These are fearless conversations where we don't just meet each other, we meet ourselves. Join us. Listen to Helga wherever you get podcasts.
Okay, y'all, we just waded through a whole lot of heavy in our extended conversation on misinformation. So now let's get offline. How about a little trip to the theater? Thanks for the program. Excuse me. Thanks. Whew, okay, you found your seat? Got your mask secured? Phone silenced? Now, shh. Lights are going down. Curtains coming up. Are you comfortable? Well, then I sure hope you bought a ticket for Wicked or The Lion King or even To Kill a Mockingbird. Because if your stub says slave play, there's really no point in settling in, because in a few moments, you are not going to be feeling so comfortable at all. The edgy, seat-squirming, mild distress about to overtake you is exactly what playwright Jeremy O'Harris wants.
When I start talking about these things, it's going to create a ruckus. And that's just because that's my nature. I've always been that. I'm a Gemini. I'm a double Gemini, Taurus, Moon. So that means I'm also stubborn. So like I'll say chaotic things and then like cause a fire and then stubbornly stand by the positions I've given to everyone around me. So I think that like the sort of that part of the fraught nature, the sort of like racial tensions that arise from the play or the sort of like emotional tensions that arise from like what it means to have these conversations in open, I was used to.
Now, Harris is best known as the writer behind the Tony-nominated Slave Play. It's a comedy that follows three interracial couples attempting to work through relationship issues by doing antebellum South sexual role play. And it's a show that asks very messy questions around race and sexuality. Slave Play ended its initial run on Broadway several months before the pandemic shut the entire theater world down. And this month, it's back on Broadway and guaranteed to upend expectations for a whole new audience.
I mean, I have so many conflicted feelings about bringing anything back for a group of people to, you know, sit in one room together and witness, right? That sense of sitting in a community with other people is so fraught right now. And it's something I think we're all getting our sea legs about. But I feel so much exhilaration when I start thinking about what it does mean that I get to do this play once again, a play I thought A, would never go to Broadway in the first place, but now it's going back for the second time, this time with an audience seeing it with new eyes. There's a real exhilaration about that.
I spoke with Jeremy O'Harris about Slave Play's return to Broadway and why audience discomfort is so important for his work.
I wanted to situate an audience, a brown audience, a black audience, a white audience, a queer audience, inside of my psyche, right? Like, I don't see the work of being a playwright, my own work of being a playwright, as a work of anything other than like inviting people who are not me to see the world through my eyes, through see my nightmares, see my dreams. And so I wanted the world that came to this play, the people that came to this play, to like live with the discomfort I've lived with as someone who's like had like a litany of like mental illnesses that were undiagnosed for most of my childhood and have had to grow up as a 6'5" black gay man for most of my life, making people uncomfortable and feeling uncomfortable in the presences of all of the institutions I was a part of. And so much of the work of the play is me creating images that I'm very comfortable with because I've lived with these images in a litany of ways for many years, and like present them to people and not letting them off the hook, because I want them to walk through Slave Play the way I feel I walk through the world, which is constantly having to reevaluate my position within it.
Everybody's uncomfortable, but I wonder if biracial folks are particularly distraught by this play.
You know what's so funny is that like, I think it depends. I mean, again, I think it truly depends. Like, you know, one of my friends who's an actress and biracial, I think she'd feel like fine with me telling you this, but she saw the play and it like energized her in this like really huge way. And she like went to her boyfriend that night and she's like, I don't think I want to date a white person right now. I just don't think I do.
Your art is breaking up relationships, man.
The amount of people who've broken up with their partners because of Slave Play is like insane. It's like actually crazy. But I mean, I think that like more so than anything, I think it woke her up to an idea, a sort of self-actualization around questions she hadn't asked herself around what she was worth inside of a relationship, inside of a country or a world that doesn't see very many places for her. I think she felt some self-actualization happen after she witnessed the play that allowed her to say, I actually think that like this is where I want to stop with you, with this journey, you know, being with sort of like a white man from a family of like very conservative Canadians, you know? I think the people who generally have the most problems with it, I've seen or I've witnessed, are often just people who are like prone to be in interracial relationships for most of their life. Those are the people who seem to have the bigger complexities with it. Whereas the children of those people, I think, see a lot of things reflected in like the play that they hadn't put language to from their childhoods.
I was going to say, you've organized a few blackout performances. What is a blackout and why was it important to you to do this?
Well, a blackout is a night at the theater that is for only Black identifying audiences. I say that knowing that that's really impossible. Like the last two blackouts, there were white people who bought tickets for the play and we weren't like, get out. Didn't you see it said blacks only? You know, we were just like, oh, hey, what's up, dude? Like,
yeah, I think that's random. Against the law if you had thrown them out. Yeah, exactly. I think we have rules about that.
It's deeply against the law. But it was quite funny because I think they're online. There's this idea that because I just said I wanted to create a safe space, an affinity space for Black people to see my play, people like there are white people online who are like, see, now if a white theater did this, you would be up in arms. I'm like, well, white theaters do it every time I go see any play. Like you go see the Lehman Trilogy and it's a whiteout. It's truly a whiteout in that audience. And I've always been the only Black person in a theater when I see plays. And I think that, you know, people forget that like it was very recently that Jim Crow laws were literally lifted from our theaters around the country, right? Like my grandmother grew up at a time when she was my age where she couldn't just go see any play she wanted because there were some theaters that wouldn't let her in. And I think that if we were going to try to rectify this like violence that was set upon like a large population in our country for like within the last 60 years, right? We have to start doing radical invitations to get those audience to feel comfortable coming back to the theater. Because it's not just about ticket prices. It's not just about location. It's not just about subject matter. Because like, look at like any Marvel movie or like before Black Panther, they all had white protagonists. And yet like Black people were going to see them in droves. Latino people were going to see them in droves. But that's because Marvel has always invited whoever wanted to come see their movie to see them, right? The theater cannot say the same of itself. And so I'm trying to do the work of re-engaging Black audiences to feel comfortable just like populating a theater the way we did in the 1920s when like the major musicals and plays and revues on Broadway were all by Black artists. Something you could read about more if you want to at a website me and my friends made called blackworkbroadway.com. God, I just plugged that so hard. But I was like, where did that come from? But like I'm really obsessed with the theater history and when the programming of theater in America shifted from having a really rich, excited space for Black audiences, a lot of the times when they were for Black affinity plays, to like the 1980s and 90s when Black audiences sort of like teetered off from the theater and stopped feeling as invited, which I think had a lot to do with like Reagan.
In October, I talked with Ruben Santiago Hudson, and I'd been to see his play the night before, and, you know, it was the first time I'd been to Broadway since the start of the pandemic, and I remembered that discomfort that I have sometimes as a Black audience member in a play that is addressing race, and sometimes there are these, like, you know, moments of humor, and I'm sitting in a predominantly white space or a, you know, highly integrated space as this one was, and, you know, white folks laughing at some jokes where I really wanted to be like, nope, not you right now. And I'm wondering about on nights that are not blackout nights, or maybe even more so on blackout nights where you nonetheless have white patrons, sort of what you make of the reactions of white audience members, maybe particularly to the moments of humor.
You know, it's crazy. And Melissa, I'm going to invite you to the blackout because it's really wild to see how free Black people are when they are away from the white gaze. Because I have never in my life thought that I wrote anything that might feel like a show that could go up at the Apollo or like something that like, you know, would like be akin to like the energy I felt when I was 9 years old and went to see the Kings of Comedy with my mom. And like, yet, like when I watched Slave Play with a fully Black audience, it was like I had made the funniest thing that had ever existed until it wasn't. And that was wild because oftentimes in the more mixed audiences that we have, you constantly see white people and Black people checking each other to see like if it's okay for them to laugh or who's laughing and how they're laughing. And I think that like that's sort of like a great metaphor for like what moving through America is often like, you know, like sitting in that audience and that sort of integrated audience is kind of what it's like. It's like, we don't know how to dance in step with the with this person who's sort of like our forced partner. It's like we're a cotillion, and like they've like told us that like we're supposed to partner with that other person, but like neither of us really wants to dance with the other. And I feel like, you know, one of the things I like about the Blackout audience is that like it's a home for Black people who never felt really, really, really at home in the theater and definitely don't feel comfortable in this like home that's not theirs to like engage with a play like Slave Play that's asking so much of audiences, right? Mm-hmm. And whereas what I like about the nights where everyone's there is that like it, like when everyone's there, it's doing the thing the play says to do in that one stage direction where it's not allowing anyone the chance to feel comfortable. And as much as I wanna give Black people as many opportunities to feel comfortable with my work as possible, I also know that the work functions better if we're in as much of a space of discomfort as possible. And I think a part of that discomfort is being like, why did that white person laugh right there? And then that white person being like, well, why did you laugh right there? You know, and like us like trying to navigate like this history, because it's a shared history. It's not a history that one of us holds, right? And that's the sort of like entanglement that Slave Play is attempting to like navigate. Is like, what does it mean that we both inherited these traumas and yet only one of us is constantly brought to the table to be like the main engager with that trauma? Like white people's engagement with the trauma of slavery is generally to say, I don't want to see that, or like that's too much, you know? And we see that all the time, right? It's like, you know, the amount of people who saw Slave Play said they loved Slave Play in 2019, in 2018, in 2017, and yet still were like so, like, you know, destroyed, wrecked by the quote unquote racial reckoning of 2020, made me feel crazy. I was like, I thought we had already talked about a lot of this stuff. I gave you guys literally half the books that people were saying that they needed to read, that they bought and probably had, you know, collecting dust on a bookshelf somewhere because they never opened it. Those were all the books I told people to read when I did my play in 2017. I've had a resource list for my play since the play first went up in New York Theater Workshop. And yet some of those same people were still like, have you read White Fragility? Everyone must buy it now.
I'm sorry, I have to laugh because I really had to go reexamine pretty much my entire adulthood right in that moment in 2020, because I was like, I spent a lot of time laboring really hard for like a decade, made a whole TV show every weekend. Was anyone listening? No one was listening. Okay, good, great, no problem.
I mean, like, it felt like, you know, the amount of people have been like, and when I brought this up, people were like, but Jeremy, it's just so different. I'm like, but what made this different than Freddie Gray?
Yeah, no.
Like, well, I mean, is this different than Ferguson? Is this different than? And you know, the only thing I can think that makes it different is that the one major character shifted. And I honestly think that people put a lot of things on George Floyd. We say his name a lot. We invoke him a lot. But I think Amy Cooper is the reason. I think that there's something really, and I think that's what Slave Play was always doing, right? With the Alana and the Jim and the Patricia and the and the Dustin, like, you know, that this play was presenting every white Hillary voter and all of their racial blind spots, right? Like, these are not people who've done anything necessarily wrong. They just are like not listening to Black people, right? They're not able to listen to their partners. And that was the core of the play that I was trying to do. And I think that's what we sort of witness white people sort of like try to wrestle with over the last year and a half. Now, I now think they have fatigue again. So I think it'll be a lot more immediate soon, and people will have some other racial reckoning that reminds them of like their whiteness and my Blackness and your Blackness in 3 years, but maybe not. You know, maybe the work will keep going and we'll keep going in a good direction. But it's sometimes hard when I have people who like literally were alive during like James Baldwin and like, you know, like Martin Luther King tell me that they don't know certain things. They didn't know certain things about the world until I wrote them in a play.
Very last one, because I can't let you out of here with just talking about the stage work. Just one beat on Zola. I think now understanding you as a double Gemini with Taurus tendencies who likes to stir the pot a bit, I understand a bit more just how wickedly weird and wonderful that film is. But talk to me a little bit about how you approach screenwriting, particularly as something that is certainly informed by your dramatic writing, but was also a very different genre.
Oh, it's a wildly different genre. And I don't think that I would have been able to endeavor it at all had I not been guided by the genius that is Janixa Bravo, right? Like, Janixa was a director and writer that I admired so much. And it felt like, you know, being someone that was like obsessed with the Beatles, getting asked to play with them, right? Or like someone obsessed with Tina Turner being asked to open. Like, that's the environment I was in with her, wherein she was like, I see your talent. I think you're an amazing writer. Now let me teach you how to do it in this manner, right? Mm-hmm. And so we just like, we took our, because Janixa also was a theater maker. We took our love of theater and we brought that to how we met the text of Asia's Twitter thread. And we decided in that moment, we would not treat this Twitter thread like anything other than an epic poem or a piece of dramatic iambic pentameter, right? Mm-hmm. And so we engaged it that way. And I think that that's why people feel so like electrified by our screenplay and like the film when they see it, because people don't know which way is up or which way is down, in that same way you feel when you come out of the Royal Court Theater after seeing like a Carol Churchill play or like a new adaptation of like a Chekhov. And so having those sensibilities with the sort of the expertise of Janixa is how I was able to navigate doing my first screenplay. But I have to say, you know, screenwriting is a beast. It's a true beast. And I think that it's a beast I'm really excited to keep wrestling. I love that, like, it's beat me up, knocked the wind out of me a couple times over the last year and a half. Because I can write a play in my sleep. I can beat a play. But like the sort of like financial restraints, the financial excesses, the many, many, many voices one is accountable to in film and television, makes it a really different place. And because I'm a stubborn Gemini, with Taurus tendencies, I know I'm going to keep wrestling with it for a long time until I move on to some other bigger beast.
That love of learning and running up a new learning curve with that challenge sounds like you got a little Libra in you too.
Well, I was raised by one.
Oh, there you go. There it is. Yeah. Jeremy O. Harris is the Tony-nominated playwright of Slave Play and co-screenwriter of Zola. Thanks so much for talking with me.
Thank you so much, Melissa. This was amazing.
All right, y'all, that's all we have for you today. But I mean, the fun does not have to end here. You can listen to shows that you've missed or even extended versions of the stories that you loved on our podcast. Now, you can find us where you find all your other podcasts. Like us, subscribe, and share. You can also find us and lots of good extras at thetakeaway.org. This way, you will never miss a show. And of course, call us with ideas, suggestions, or if you know anyone who needs a shout out in our transformative takeaways. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Now, come on back tomorrow, because Dorian Warren will be here with me, and we're taking a deep dive into childbirth. Trust me, you do not want to miss this. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway.